Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How political should a college education be? As many current and former students are aware, a fair number of university professors make their personal opinions known. And while the percentage of those who actively work to indoctrinate undergraduates may be relatively small, my guest today says overtly partisan lectures and curricula detract from the quality of an education. Stanley Fish is professor of law at Florida International University and dean emeritus of the School of the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences at the University of Illinois at Chicago. His book, Save the World on Your Own Time, is out now in paperback. Stanley, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here.
Are universities in 2012 inherently political institutions?
They don't need to be inherently political institutions, and it depends on two things. What kind of view of education professors have, and what kind of discipline administrations are willing to exert.
There are people who think it's self-evident that the goal of education should be social justice.
Yes, there are. And there's a movement called Teaching for Social Justice, and many honorable people enrolled in that movement. My response to that is to ask a simple question, which is, what are we as professors, instructors in colleges or universities, both trained to do and paid to do? What we're trained to do is introduce students to materials, bodies of materials and traditions they weren't familiar with before, and then also to confer on them the appropriate skills. They might be analytic, library skills, laboratory skills that would allow them to move around in those traditions. And that seems to me to be the parameter for the task, or as we might say, for the job. So nothing either in the way we were trained nor in the contract we signed when we took a position at a university says that we should be preaching social justice or advocating political agendas or forming citizens in a certain way. And so I don't understand where these ideas come from.
Is there an uneven balance right now between liberal and conservative viewpoints on college campuses?
Well, I think balance is a false issue. If you're teaching a course, it shouldn't matter at all what your partisan registration might be. That is, how you vote when you go into the ballot box. That should have no relationship whatsoever to your teaching of the material, because what you should be doing with the material is interrogating it according to academic norms. And that means inquiring into its history, the shape and structure, who are the prominent persons, what are the important texts, what goals or ambitions in terms of advancing knowledge does the field have. None of those questions touch at all on the political affiliation of the instructor.
What was so interesting to me, Stanley, reading the book, was that it strikes me that what you're trying to do is create individuals in universities who go on to be lifelong learners rather than looking at their time in college as the end of their education.
That's right. And, of course, the politicization of the university goes hand in hand, at least in terms of the recent decades, with an attitude toward the university or college that makes it a utilitarian experience. That is, you ask the question, after I get out of this course or graduate from this university with this major, what are my job prospects? I can understand, of course, the pressures that lead people to think that way, but thinking that way is absolutely antithetical to what education really is.
So what else creeps into university classes that does not belong there?
Well, politics certainly, but politics can take any number of forms. Also the idea that we should be not merely introducing students into traditions of moral inquiry, but that we should be actively trying to make our students into certain kinds of moral beings. And I want to resist all of that, although I think that mine is perhaps a minority position. Just happens to be the right one.
In some ways, what you're suggesting sounds like what is expected of journalists, and whether or not this actually happens in the modern world, we could spend hours discussing elsewhere. But it's this sort of straight, unbiased account of a particular subject.
Well, unbiased is a tricky thing. Let's say that it depends on what kind of subject matter comes into your course. I have no rules for exiling subject matter. Any subject matter can come into a course so long as it is treated in an academic manner. And by that I mean it's treated as an object of an analysis rather than as a candidate for political embrace. So you could bring in, for example, to take a hot-button issue, a discussion of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and you could do a course on its history and on its relationship to events in the 19th century, and then look at the ways in which the dispute plays out in the Middle East, how it affects American politics. You could do all of that without ever nudging your students in the direction of coming down on one side or the other, because that, I think, is not your job. And you shouldn't be, to use the word that you introduced the question with, you shouldn't be biased or be directing your students to have a bias in either direction. But on the other hand, if the matter is an entirely academic one, you're arguing about the structure, let's say, of Milton's Paradise Lost or one of Jane Austen's novels, and you as the instructor have a view as to what the right answer is, then I don't think that you should hold back from delivering that view and then inviting, of course, students to debate it or to add to it. And again, the difference is that when you're talking about the interpretation of a literary work, you are not urging your students to take a political course of action. When you're talking about a topic that is alive politically today, you have to be more careful.
You know, we talked yesterday on this show with Jonathan Haidt about the biological and cultural factors that play into our political persuasions as we're adults. And the reality is that most people believe that their ideas about things are based entirely on the facts that they have gathered, and that they are rational perspectives. Do you find, I mean, is there any reason to expect that university professors are any more aware of the fact that their opinions are opinions and that they are subjective than the average person who thinks that his or her opinions are objective?
Well, we have to, again, be careful about which opinions a professor might hold. My opinion about Paradise Lost or about Jane Austen or about the meaning of the First Amendment is an opinion that I hold in high regard, and I regard it so because behind my opinion you will find years of study and publication and recognition by my peers that my view is, if not an authoritative one, at least a central one in the field. So in that case, I think that professors are perfectly justified, especially in their relationships with students, to hold their own views out as being correct and more carefully thought out than the views of at least most students. But as for the other kind of views, the views we were talking about a moment ago, views about the political questions of the day, the directions our foreign policy should take, questions like abortion or affirmative action, there the professor, while he or she may teach the history of that subject, should never tip his or her hand as to what the views that he or she holds are. Sorry for all those his or hers.
That's quite all right. Thank you for being inclusive. We should note that you are not saying that university professors don't have a right on their own time, as it refers to the title of your book, to believe whatever they want, to be as active politically as they want, and in fact to publish based on what they believe.
That's right. I mean, a university professor or a college professor steps out of the classroom and goes home and perhaps writes a letter to the editor on some hot button issue of the day, or goes to a political rally, or signs up in a political campaign office and offers either time or money in support of a candidate. Those are all activities that are available to every citizen of the United States. No reason why they shouldn't be available also to professors. So long as those activities are not then brought back in a direct and proselytizing way into the classroom.
Stanley Fish is my guest this hour. He's professor of law at Florida International University and dean emeritus of the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences at the University of Illinois at Chicago. His book, Save the World on Your Own Time, is now available in paperback. We'll come back to our discussion with Stanley Fish in just a couple of minutes, and you can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or let us know what you're thinking via email to think@kera.org. Joining us now in the studio for the next couple of minutes is Jeff Winnington. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. I want to thank Elizabeth and Justin Vaughn in Dallas, Gwen Meeks in Carrollton, Constanza Ward in Garland, also Lisa Quintana in North Richland Hills, and Alan Reese and Anthony Lopez in Grand Prairie. We've heard from all over the North Texas area here. In just the last few minutes, Chris, thank you so much to each of you. Follow the lead of these fine folks. Please, won't you please call 888-694-6931 or go online to kera.org, make a contribution. If you make a $120 contribution or become a sustaining member at the $10 a month level, we'll thank you with your very own copy of Professor Fish's book.
It's been a very influential piece of work. It's, of course, now in its paperback edition. It came out in hardback last year. It's had lots of discussion and debate. We're discussing it today with Professor Fish, but, of course, you may want to pick it up and read it for yourself. We are excited on this show. We are privileged to be able to introduce ideas that get you thinking. We are happy that we don't have to be in a position of saying, you must believe this, you shouldn't believe that. We leave it up to you. We respect your intelligence, and we are able to do that because we don't have to falsely generate controversy in order to win advertising sponsors. Your money is what supports us. And if you believe this approach really helps you to learn about the world, to make your own decisions and your own evaluations, your support is vital to keeping this station healthy. You can go online and make a contribution at kera.org, or you can call in to 1-888-694-6931.
And no matter what the topic is, it may be entertaining, but it certainly will be an intelligent discussion. And although we could do an hour on crazy things that Chris's daughter says, which, trust me, we could write a book on that. we don't do that kind of radio here. That kind of radio is out there. This public radio experience that you've signed up for just by tuning in to 90.1, and again, we're thrilled to have you as a listener, but this, it has an expense. There's a cost associated with this. There's a significant cost associated with the national programming we bring to you on KERA. It's well over $1 million a year at this point just to bring you the national programming. And that does include what we produce right here in North Texas in our studio right here on Harry Hines Boulevard in Dallas. This show is produced for you every single day right here with you in mind. We get great thinkers and great speakers from all over the country, either on the phone, sometimes via studio. Sometimes they come through town. We talk to great speakers and thinkers from here in North Texas as well, and we're thrilled to do it. It's a real pleasure to be able to host these conversations for you on your behalf every single day. We're just asking you to help pay for it. That's all we're asking.
You obviously think someone should support KERA because you're sitting here on someone else's dime, enjoying the station and paying attention. Why not you? Why not join the group of people who support this station with their funding? You know, the great thing is you can decide what you can afford. If you can do $5 a month on the sustaining membership plan, that's fantastic. If you can do $500 a month, and we do have people who are giving at that level and above, we'd love to hear from you. But the reality is we just ask that everyone who listens to this station, everyone who has chosen KERA as their radio station, which we know you have, makes a contribution. You can do this over the phone at 1-888-694-6931 or save us a little money on processing. Also check out thank you gifts, including copies of Stanley Fish's book, Save the World on Your Own Time, which is available at $120. You can do that by going online to kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris. Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Stanley Fish. He's professor of law at Florida International University and dean emeritus of the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences at the University of Illinois at Chicago. His book, Save the World on Your Own Time, is now available in paperback. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Stanley, as we are discussing today on this radio station, universities are also constantly looking for new sources of funding.
Yes.
How does the issue of the way that professors convey their personal opinions play into the ability of a university to garner funding?
I don't think that that plays into the university's ability to garner funding. I think funding, however, in today's universities does present a problem and a challenge to the kind of educational experience that I'm speaking up for. So many people now are seeking corporate partnerships and therefore accepting funds to underwrite their programs of research. And it becomes difficult at times to resist the temptation to become mouthpieces or at least agents of the corporation or donor funding you. So that's something that has to be recognized and resisted when it can be resisted.
Would it make any difference to have professors, to require professors to sort of disclose their views before they teach a class?
No, I think that's exactly the wrong thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are some people who believe that if they stand up and say, well, these are my views, now you can
take them or leave
them. Aware of them. And so, but that's to suggest that the arrival at political or ideological views is the business of the classroom, and I'm just letting you know what mine are as a courtesy or as a safeguard, but that isn't the business of the classroom, to arrive at ideological positions. So that I think that people who announce their biases, as they put it, up front and then believe that they've discharged a responsibility and insulated themselves from the charge of being political, are being political simply by doing that.
How often do students report that they feel a sort of pressure, whether these are their views or not, to mirror what the views of their professors are?
Well, again, we'd have to make a distinction. Students may well feel that they know what their professors' views on the First Amendment or on Paradise Lost are, and that influences them.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as students wishing or thinking that they must echo their professor's political views, that, of course, depends on those views having been announced, and they shouldn't be. But as a matter of anecdotal evidence and some hard reporting by those who have written books on this subject, there are teachers across the country who do believe that the classroom is legitimately a theater for their political or ideological agendas. And I'm now writing a new book on academic freedom, a very vexed topic, where one version of academic freedom, far on the left, does in fact say that academics should be free to fight oppression and to battle for justice in the classroom, because that's in fact what they are supposed to do. And as you might imagine, I'm going to say once again, no, that's not what they are supposed to do.
Do you think there's any danger that not modeling political activism for students on campus means that they are somehow unprepared to engage politically in the real world once they leave the university?
I don't know, but it's not our our job to introduce students to ways of political activity. That is, whether or not the student who leaves our classroom is able to function either in the political world or in the business world should not be a matter of concern to the instructor. The instructor should be concerned with conveying the mastery of the material that he or she should have to the students. A successful course is one in which the student can now go out and do independent research, should the student wish to, without the guidance of the instructor. If you've mapped out the field for the students and then equipped them with the necessary skills, you have done your job. And let me say that that is a very big job. And it's hard to do, and I don't see why anyone would think that there is time left over for engaging in political propaganda.
We have an email here from Joe who writes, are you saying that in matters of the right thing to do, one should not, for example, one should not purposefully hurt another, that that's not something a college professor should impart to students?
Because that is correct. Mm-hmm. One can study that very old question. Exactly what does it mean to inflict harm? One, for example, would immediately go to J.S. Mill's classic treatise on liberty, where he discusses exactly this question and comes up with the harm principle, that is, individuals should be free to do as they like, so long as what they do doesn't result in harm to others. You would then study the objections made in Mill's time, and since Mill wrote that book to that thesis, the problems that it generates that he perhaps wasn't attuned to at the time, so that you could again study the subject. I have a name for this. It's a quite ugly word. I say what you have to do with any topic is academicize it. And what that means is that you detach the topic from its real-world urgency, where the question is, well, what shall we as a nation do now? And insert the topic into a context of academic urgency in which you're saying, well, what is the proper analysis of the history of this matter, of the proper understanding of what Mill is trying to do in On Liberty, or the proper understanding of where his critics were coming from. That's the distinction that I'm trying to make.
What do you say to people who say, well, that's just more ivory tower stuff, and it really it removes the experience of a university of education from the experience of real life?
I think that's absolutely fine. Ivory tower is a good thing. There's plenty of life to be lived once you step outside of the classroom or out of your four-year education, and it will be there waiting for you. What won't be waiting for you is the experience of contemplation and extended interrogation that should be the basis of what goes on in a college classroom.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from the Reverend Ruth Atterbury, who says, when I was a student at Perkins School of Theology, Dr. Joette Bassler consistently put before us the options for interpreting New Testament texts, scholarly support for each, and the one she found compelling, with no expectation we would agree with her choice. I've tried to model that approach in my own teaching.
That sounds right, and I do the same thing in relation, well, not quite. Since I teach law, I'm teaching the various interpretive alternatives when it comes to constitutional law and statutes. And there are three, textualism, intentionalism, and the living constitution theory, and I teach those views, but I'm afraid I don't teach them in a disinterested way. I believe that one of them is correct and that the other two are faulty for reasons that I then give. But again, I'm not asking my students to go out and do something. I'm just telling my students which of a series of theories of interpretation I believe to be the true or correct one.
Are you happy when they argue back with you and say, we disagree?
Yes, I'm happy when they argue back with me, but they never win the argument.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phones now. We'll speak with Sam in Richardson. Hi, Sam.
Hi there.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Yeah, so my question was along the lines of, is there a downside to not talking about or to removing political opinion from the classroom? The context is I went to a religious school, and, you know, that was part of a selling point of the religious institution. The private religious institution was, we could talk about faith in the classroom. We could talk about our religion in the context of secular learning. And that was an upside. So is there an upside, you know, to having a place where you can talk about political ideas in the classroom?
No, I don't think there's any upside, because that would mean that the classroom now became an adjunct of political deliberation leading to activity. The question is one of distinctiveness. Is there a distinctive academic task, something that the academic experience provides that other experiences do not provide? And if the answer to that is no, if the academic task is just an adjunct of some other task, then you have the very vexing question, well, if that's so, why do we need it? Why can't we go directly to that other task, whether it's politics or theology or making money or whatever it might be? So that everything depends, at least in the context of my thesis, on the distinctiveness of academic work, and all of my arguments are arguments for protecting and preserving that distinctiveness. Now, religion is something that I teach all the time. That's the course that I teach every year, religion and the law. And so I am always talking about religious texts and religious disputes in the law and elsewhere. But I am never, of course, urging my students in the direction either of a particular religion or in the direction of a hostility to religion.
As you allowed earlier, there are not there's not a huge movement among your colleagues to follow this idea. Assuming that they did, for the sake of this argument, how would university administrators realistically impose policies requiring instructors not to discuss certain things in certain ways in the classroom?
No, I don't think that you have to require instructors not to discuss things. As I said earlier, anything, any topic, any subject can be discussed, so long as it's discussed in an academic way and not in a partisan or proselytizing way. And well, that's all that you have to say to faculty members. You're here to impart, hand down, your knowledge of a tradition of inquiry and also to equip your students with certain relevant skills. You're not here to do other jobs, although you, of course, may wish to do those jobs on your own time. Now, as for a mechanism, I think that the only realistic mechanism would be the complaint of students that they felt pressured to adopt some ideological or theological or political point of view. And then there should be, and on many campuses there is, a set of procedures that is followed in order to determine whether the instructor was in fact doing his or her job or was trading that job for some other activity. An activity, by the way, that might be perfectly worthwhile and even noble, but it just isn't the activity that belongs in the classroom.
Stanley Fish is my guest. We're talking about his book, available now in paperback, Save the World on Your Own Time. We'll come back to the conversation in a moment. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or via email to think@kera.org. We're taking another break of just a couple of minutes here now to remind you that we are in the midst of our spring membership campaign. We are raising funds to keep the station that you value strong and healthy, keep it going until the next time we raise funds. You can make your contribution online right now, and we ask that you do make your contribution right now at kera.org or over the phone at 1-888-694-6931. Think's senior producer Jeff Whittington is here with me now in studio. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Chris, and what a fascinating conversation. We're getting great comments from the audience, too. It's really a thrill to see when you call, when you email in. We're so excited that you participate in this show and in these conversations every day because, after all, you're the ones that we're making the radio show for. This is your forum every day. And you know, the idea behind Think is that we give you something that's hopefully thought-provoking and hopefully will provoke conversation and maybe even will encourage you to go a little further and maybe read the guest's book. Maybe read some articles that are related to it. Maybe look up some differing opinions. And you know, we'll bring those differing opinions to the show at some point. Either maybe we already have, or maybe we're revisiting a topic. So it's really exciting, and the conversation today is great. I hope that you are going to the phone right now or pulling out your cell phone and dialing 888-694-6931. I hope that you're making your contribution online. You're probably sitting at your desk. You're back from lunch. Maybe you're listening to the second hour of the show. Maybe this is your typical habit in the afternoon. Well, click over to kera.org. You're right there at the computer already, and make a contribution.
You can receive a copy of Stanley Fish's book, Save the World on Your Own Time, when you make a contribution at the $120 level or above. As you know, if you want to do a sustaining membership, we can take that out of your checking or debit card account or credit card account these days at $10 a month, which is really affordable. And, you know, many people pay fees that high in an average month to their bank. And for that amount of money, you are receiving phenomenal radio, not only for yourself, for your family, but also giving this as a gift to your community here in North Texas. Get in touch with us now to make your gift of support at KERA.org or at 1-888-694-6931.
Yeah, think about it like you would a subscription to anything else. I'm not going to tell you what my mobile phone monthly bill is, but I bet you can relate. If you have a smartphone and a data plan, and then maybe you even have cable, or you have a magazine or newspaper subscription, maybe you just have a digital-only subscription to the New York Times. You still have to pay for that. Well, you don't have to pay for KERA, but if nobody gave money to the station, it wouldn't be here. There'd be no Morning Edition in Dallas, Fort Worth, Metroplex. There'd be no Diane Rehm Show or Fresh Air or Think with Chris Boyd or shows you here in the afternoon. There'd be no All Things Considered in the afternoon. Imagine how bleak your, information and even entertainment landscape would be without public radio. If you think about that and then think, is it worth $5 a month? I tell you what, give $5 a month to the station and we will send you a Think coffee mug. And it's a quintessential public radio gift, the coffee or tea or whatever beverage you want mug, the ceramic mug, but it has the Think logo on it. It's pretty cool. And we're happy to offer that as a thank you gift at the $60 membership level today.
1-888-694-6931 is the number. You can also go online to KERA.org. Jeff, as you mentioned, you can squeak by without making a contribution to the station, but it is an incredibly generous, civic-minded thing to do. It doesn't have to take a lot out of your budget, and it matters to this station. Please don't think that your contribution doesn't matter or your lack of a contribution doesn't matter. Our ability to staff up for programs that you really care about, including this one for our news programming, that ability to hire people and have us all work for you is about your willingness to give money to the station.
It takes many individuals, many individual strands to make the rope strong. And it takes many individuals to make public radio strong. And it takes many of you, and whatever your contribution level is fine, to make KERA strong. So please don't wait. Call 1-888-694-6931 or click and join at KERA.org.
Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Stanley Fish. He is professor of law at Florida International University and dean emeritus of the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences at the University of Illinois at Chicago. His book is out now in paperback. It's called Save the World on Your Own Time. Join this conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or via email to think@kera.org. Stanley, what concerns you about the way that universities teach students to write these days?
Oh, now you're going to need another 2 hours. it's in fact a byproduct of my general concern in the book. At a certain point in the 70s, people began to think that the teaching of writing was in fact training for, if not revolution, at least for inculcating a certain set of progressive political views. And when that happened, the craft of writing took a back seat, and that's modest. In some cases, the craft of writing was forgotten entirely, and in some other cases, the idea of the craft of writing, where there were right and wrong ways to do things, was regarded as an imposition of some kind of illegitimate authority on students who should be allowed to write in ways that seemed correct to them.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to David in Denton. Hi, David.
Hi. I was curious While the objective seems laudable to not be political, it seems almost impossible. I'm an instructor in history, and when I'm teaching about the causes of the Great Depression, I have to mention the failure of the banking system and over-concentration of wealth, and there's such obvious political implications of that, same with global warming and evolution. Is it possible to be apolitical?
I'm not saying to be apolitical, and I'm not saying to not be political. I'm saying to be academic, and those other things take care of themselves. That is, if you're teaching any of those subjects, and I teach evolution and creation science as subjects because they turn up in law cases all the time, I teach them every year. But I never have to teach them in a way that nudges students in the direction of taking one side or the other, because my whole goal in the course is to explore, lay bare, and atomize, and analyze a whole series of words that could be used, the set of issues that now are before the public. But they are not in the classroom before the public. In the classroom, they are before the academic community, of which the classroom is a small example. So any topic that you're teaching can be, as I said earlier, academicized. There's another question which I think that your question might be touching on, and is that is no doubt each of us has his or her own political, ideological, theological, or anti-theological views. How is it possible to keep those views from filtering into what we teach, no matter what intentions we might have? And that's a legitimate question, and the answer to that is that you just try very hard, and you're going to be able to filter out a good many of them, and the ones that you can't filter out because they're not in your control won't be doing that much damage, at least in the context of trying to do pedagogical good. There's a huge difference from going into a classroom and saying, what I'm going to try to do is lay out the subject matter, and on the other hand, saying what I'm going to try to do is teach the subject matter in a way that will slant it toward my ideological preferences. The fact that you can perhaps not 100% do the first doesn't mean that it isn't the preferable view.
In your experience, would most professors who are perhaps allowing their personal views to creep into these very contentious subjects, are they aware that they're doing it?
Some are and some aren't. When it's pointed out to them, I've had some people say, oh, and realize I'm, for example, let's take a small example. Let's say you have an office, and on the office door there's a bulletin board, and inside the office there is room to hang posters or pictures. You should not, either on the bulletin board or inside your office, hang posters or pictures that identify your political positions. Because your office is an extension of the classroom, and when a student walks into your office, he or she should not feel that certain points of view are favored in this space and other views are disfavored. When I pointed that out to people who had never thought about it before, often they will say, yes, I guess you're right. So those are ways in which a professor might not be aware of the degree to which his students were being exposed to some kind of ideological position. But, of course, there are a great many people, those who belong to the teaching social justice movement and others, who think that my views are not only entirely wrong, it's not a question that it's not impossible. They wouldn't say it's impossible to do what I am urging. They would be saying that it's unworthy to do what I am urging, because as human beings, and especially as human beings with a good deal of education, we should be in the forefront of the battles for social justice.
You've taught at different places. In your experience, does the culture of certain universities lend itself to a more sort of balanced, academicized, to use your word, view of contentious subjects than others?
No, I don't find that. I find that it's a generational question. Many faculty members who are now in senior positions came into those positions after the 1960s, when the ambitious political hopes of that generation were not quite realized, and when it seemed that the powers that be had reasserted themselves, let's say, with the election of presidents like Nixon or Lyndon Johnson. So those people then found a new field in their own minds for doing the work, for continuing the cause in the classroom. Now, that generation is in the process of retiring. And so it may be that those who are now coming up in the ranks, who are just entering the tenured and full professor ranks, may have a different set of attitudes. We'll have to see.
We've got time to take one more call, and that comes to us from Jennifer in Denton. Hi, Jennifer.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I just wanted to add to what David in Denton had mentioned about certain subjects requiring basically value judgments that have to
there
be...
There are none.
There, you're in the business program, then you profit is a goal. You're in a public administration program, then social equity is a goal. There are certain values related to certain subjects that have to be accepted in order to academically understand it.
What you can accept and academically understand are the set of positions, and you can teach that certain values or presuppositions or assumptions underlie those positions. That doesn't mean that you have to urge those values or think that the classroom is the place where they have to be urged. To use a word that I've overused during this interview, those values, like anything else that comes into the classroom, should be interrogated. Now, the business school issue is an interesting one because, in a way, professional schools like the law school, the business school, the education school of education, perhaps medical school, don't fit my model because they have an agenda which drives all of the courses. And that then leads to the question whether schools of education, schools of engineering, and schools of business are in any meaningful sense academic. And the answer to that question may be no.
Last thing I want to ask you is what colleges and universities should do with regard to extracurricular student groups that want to demonstrate on campus.
I think that they should be allowed to do so within the time, place, and manner rules that exist on most universities. That means that there are regulations for when and where students can organize. In some universities, there is a requirement that student organizations be registered with the committee that superintends student organizations, so that there are all kinds of ways in which students, once they exit from the classroom onto the larger parts of the campus, can participate in political activities. But, of course, those activities, once they turn disruptive, are going to be subject to all the disciplinary actions that any disruption, not only in a university, but in an office building or in an airport or anywhere else, would be subject to.
Stanley Fish is professor of law at Florida International University and dean emeritus of the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences at the University of Illinois at Chicago. His book, Save the World on Your Own Time, is out now in paperback. Stanley, it's been a very interesting hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. You asked great questions. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you. Thanks to all of you who have listened this hour, called in to participate, written email to participate, and especially we want to thank those of you who have made financial contributions during Think Today. You can join this esteemed group of listeners by going online to kera.org or by calling in your pledge to 1-888-694-6931. The truth is, Jeff Whittington, they're not so much pledges anymore because most people pay with instantaneous methods
remuneration.
Of payment. Of remuneration.
Yeah.
Yes.
We make a contribution. I mean,
yeah,
really,
that's
the best way to look at it. Look, we're asking you to make a contribution. We used to call it the pledge drive. Some of us have been here long enough that we still do. We used to say make a pledge. Some of us have been here long enough that we still do.
We can't help it.
Your pledge counts, things like that. You remember, it's kind of, you know, it's language from when we'd write everything down and then we'd send you a bill and you'd send a check in. And now it's so easy. You can go online to the Safe and Secure website. You see the little lock down in the corner when you're on the support page of kera.org. So you know it's safe. It's you fill out the information. It's like making any purchase or any contribution online. It's the same kind of thing that you do when and if you do that. But if you want to talk to somebody, call 888. It's 1-888-694-6931, and they will explain the membership process to you, and they'll get your personal information, how you want to pay. You can still send a check. We will still send you an invoice, but you can use your credit card. You can use your debit card. You can do pretty much anything you want. We want to make it as easy as possible for you to contribute to the station, and that's what we're asking you to do. Make a contribution. Please do it now. Make one of at least $120. We'll send you a copy of Stanley Fish's book with our thanks.
The book is called Save the World on Your Own Time. You can join the station at the $120 contribution level and receive a copy, or choose any number of other thank you gifts if something else interests you more. Lots of you don't take a thank you gift. That's fine, too. We just take your entire contribution and put it to work for you, producing and purchasing and streaming and airing the programming that you count on KERA all the time. Many of you we know are listening right now and are podcast listeners. We so love having you as part of our audience, whether you live in the North Texas area or on six of the seven continents. We know we have listeners all over. Your contribution also matters to the station and will allow us to continue producing this podcast and making it available to you every day.
Are you suggesting that there aren't people on Antarctica listening to the Think Show?
I'm saying we have no one in Australia. No, I'm kidding. Yeah, of course, it's Antarctica. But maybe there are. You never know.
Yeah, I mean, that McMurdo Station.
Frozen scientific outpost.
It is a deep, dark, almost winter there, I think. I think the last plane is due to leave any day if it hasn't already.
I don't even like thinking about how lonely and cold that would be.
Well, we haven't gotten a contribution yet from Antarctica, but we have gotten some contributions, including one from IPON in Fort Worth, Meredith Case in Fort Worth, Richard Jordan in Dallas, Ray Goodwin in Bedford, Irene Smith in Granbury, Scott Wilkinson in Greenville, Gordon Byrne in Dallas, and it's not Antarctica, but it is Lucien, Oklahoma, where we heard from Ruth Atterbury.
Thank you, Ruth.
Thank you so much to everybody who has supported the station today, especially during the Think Show. But if we have yet to hear from you, lines are open, 888-694-6931. The web is always open. Melt the web. Make a contribution at kera.org. If everyone listening right now who has an opinion that, oh, yeah, maybe I should, if you just go ahead and do it, we'd really get down the road on this thing.
You know, there comes a time, I think, in everybody's life where you realize you've gone from being maybe cared for by your parents and your family and other adults in your life, and you start taking responsibility for yourself. And part of that responsibility at some point turns into recognizing that the things that you think are important in your community, the things you want to exist in the world, that you have the power to make them possible. And in this case, what we're asking of you is really quite simple. We're not asking you to, you know, dig a pipeline or build a village. We're saying make a contribution of financial support. Send money to kera.org or over the phone at 1-888-694-6931 and take responsibility for public radio, KERA.
Yeah, this is your station. There are stations like it all over the country, hundreds of public radio stations that run NPR and PRI and American Public Media Programming. But this one's yours. And, you know, and this station and the people who've already given are counting on you to join them. You know, if you would just join the station and join all the folks that have contributed already, this thing would be over in no time. And we would get right back to the regular schedule. You know, it's a big deal, of course, when we make the goal, but we just get right back to programming. I mean, that's our guarantee to you. It's we're back on the air doing what you expect, what you've come to count on every single day.
It really does feel good to make a contribution, to be part of the formula that makes KERA work. We love to hear from you during Think and during Jeff's show, anything you ever wanted to know, because we know lots of you make a date each day of the week with the programming we have at the midday hour, because it's important to you, because it's locally produced. We're able to produce local programming thanks to contributions from people like you.
888-694-6931. Or go online to kera.org, make your contribution there. We really appreciate your support, and thanks.